Welcome to the Ortho Joke Podcast, a joint production of the Journal of Bone and Joint Surgery and Ortho Evidence. Join hosts Mohit Bhandari and Mark Swankowski as they discuss current topics and publications in the world of orthopedics and beyond.
Okay. Good morning, Mo.
Morning, Mark.
What do you got? What are you drinking this morning?
Oh, you know, good old Canadian Tim Hortons.
Tim Hortons. Yeah, well, I'll tell you, I am profoundly depressed because the Leafs are in trouble, down 3-1. And the drought since 1967 may continue, but I'll try to keep my positive attitude about everything else in life. Today, we have got a very important topic of sex and women in orthopedic surgery research and clinical research. And we've got two wonderful guests who have been very instrumental in this area and also in leading, I would say, a conference that we did in November in Boston that we'll talk quite a bit about. But we have Seth Leopold, who probably doesn't need much introduction to the orthopedic research world as the editor-in-chief of CORE. And a professor at the University of Washington, adult reconstruction surgeon. And Seth, I think you've been in that job more than a decade, I believe. I think you predated me for sure. So congratulations on a great tenure in that position.
Thank you, Mark.
We have Kim Templeton, who led the effort to do this conference. And I'll give a brief introduction about how that happened. But Kim is a professor at the University of Kansas. She's a orthopedic oncologist. I believe it's correct that you're still the program director at KU. Is that accurate?
Actually, I've moved on from that. I'm now vice chair of faculty development and also the associate dean for continuing medical education at the university.
That's been your career trajectory. It's always bigger jobs. And Kim has worked for decades in this area. And in fact, is the past president of the American Medical Women's Society. So it's outside of orthopedic that Dr. Templeton has exerted her leadership and skills and knowledge in this area. So a brief background about this conference that was organized in November at the airport in Boston. We did a similar symposium in 2018 on pain management research. Our journals, and I think Seth would agree with this, we're being inundated with pain manuscripts of how many pills do you give and, you know, not very well done research, some other administrative database research that really wasn't well done. And we came together and did a conference in Massachusetts that resulted in a symposium that's been fairly widely cited. And when we were organizing this, I was contacted by Dr. Templeton and she said, you know, I think you're really missing the boat if you don't have a section in this on the considerations for sex and gender in pain research. And Dr. Templeton participated, authored an article, and from there, we entertained the option of doing a larger symposium on this topic. And Dr. Templeton wrote a grant to NIAMS, received a large R13 award, and we were able to do the conference. And now she is working on editing the final manuscripts, which we hope will be out in the summer or fall. I won't press anybody on that because these things are hard work. And as a part of that, the editors of all of the orthopedic journals were invited to participate. About a half dozen showed up. And it quickly became apparent that Dr. Leopold knew the most about this topic, and CORE had done the most work of all the major journals on this area. And I would just want to thank you, Seth, for all of your leadership in organizing the way we communicated with other journal editors, et cetera. I would maybe let me just start with you, and then my colleague, Dr. Bhandari, will jump in. How long had CORE been working in trying to clarify the important issues in sex and gender research in orthopedics?
Well, the most important thing to clarify is I think the person who knows the most about this is Kim. But as far as the journal side, it would be that it was really one of the first things I did. I started in late 2012, and our editorial on it came out in early 2014, which Sager, as you saw, you know, used as a basis for what they did, and the ICMJE used as a basis for what they did on this topic. probably 10 years ago. So ours came out in 2014, but it wasn't because we started in 2014. We started in, you know, late 2012, and these are complicated conversations, as you saw at a symposium that you were kind enough to host. I walked in with great naivete to our editorial board meeting with a lot of ideas about what I thought ought to happen and could happen. And people who knew more about this subject than I did said, you know, you need to tap the brakes and be circumspect about how you roll out editorial policies on something as important as this. And so I learned a lot from working with our senior editors on this back in 2013. And that's really when we did most of the work.
So I wonder, either Seth or Kim, maybe I'll start with you, Kim. When you talk about the symposium itself and in a supplement or, you know, in the writing that's coming out, what are the current pervasive issues that we need to be tackling? And I know there's probably a large list of them, but if you were to sort of prioritize the ones that we really have to move on, what would they be?
It's a great question. And I would also join with Dr. Leopold in thanking JBJS and Dr. Swankowski for hosting this symposium, because I think we made some progress. I think at the heart of this is getting investigators to at least think about whether sex or gender impacts the condition that they're studying. If it's something that occurs in both women and men, and from an orthopedic perspective, that's pretty much everything, at least think about it. If there is an insufficient sample size to be able to disaggregate data based on sex, then at least explain that. But think about it ahead of time when you're designing the study, when you're designing how you're going to analyze and report the data. So to me, that is the biggest challenge that hopefully this entire effort will help to address, is just to get people to think about it. I think it's frustrating as a reviewer for JBJS and for CORE when I read an article and there's this beautiful table that shows how many men or women participated in the study, and that's the last you ever hear about it. That's a bit frustrating, because if, as an investigator, you're going to take the time to count the number of people in your study, then take it the next step. And if that next step is saying, we would love to disaggregate data based on sex because it may be important, may not, we don't know until we look, but the sample size wasn't large enough, and therefore if we had done that, it could have led to erroneous results, that's fine, because it alerts your reader to at least you thought about it. But you also may have an energetic young researcher who reads this and says, then I'm going to design the next study that does have a large enough sample size. But simply leaving it at counting doesn't really, in my opinion, move the field forward.
Are there just broad areas within orthopedics that, you know, we should be, you know, paying a special attention to? Or is this at this point more of a statement to say, listen, any large program or any program where you think you have enough sufficient sample size, I guess, to some degree, where you can actually try to understand the, you know, sort of the modifying effect of gender and sex, we should be doing that routinely. But are there areas where you'd say, we have an idea, this area might be important, please, when you're doing this type of work, we want you to really look at sex and gender very specifically in these?
I would say across the board, whatever you're studying, at least think about it. But top of mind for me, and that's Mark had referenced that earlier in the article that I wrote, sort of the passion of mine, is pain. There are both sex and gender differences in pain, as far as we're aware. It's hard to tease out which is more important, which is more important probably isn't relevant. But it's better understanding that, because pain is such a critical outcome metric that we look at in orthopedics. We know that women have more chronic pain. What we don't know is what their adaptation is to acute pain, such as somebody who has no other health conditions, they twist their ankle, they break their ankle, and then we're going to try to fix it. Do women respond differently to acute pain? Are there different long-term outcomes? And the reason I think that looking at pain is important is not only to inform individual patient care, but then when you're trying to do things like develop clinical practice guidelines for pain or whatever you're developing guidelines for, not to have the data is challenging. For example, I participated on the Academy's project on developing clinical practice guidelines on pain management after pelvis and extremity surgery. And going through the articles that helped inform the guideline, none of them included sex-specific analyses except for the studies that looked at cognitive behavioral therapy. And that's noted as a limitation at the very beginning of the clinical practice guideline. So I think pain considering how important that is to orthopedic outcomes is something where we need to understand that better, and not just understanding why men or women may have more pain, but how then do they respond to interventions? And so if you're doing an intervention such as, you know, a regional block or something for a procedure, identify whether men and women had a different response, because that can help inform patient care. That also can inform the outcome metrics that we're using. As you know, the vast majority of outcome metrics somewhere in there have pain as a measure. Well, if women and men experience pain differently, do we then need to develop different outcome measures for men and women? Because it may look like women have worse outcomes, and that's solely based on the fact that they have more pain.
Yeah, so in a little bit later time in the discussion, Kim, we'll ask you to discuss the experts that you had outside of orthopedics, but they were very, very important in the discussion. Seth, you really took a lead role with Kim on how we were going to interact with the other orthopedic journals, the other 70 to 80 orthopedic journals, in encouraging them to read a suggested way to proceed that came out of the conference. What were your thoughts in leading us as to how we should connect with them and what we should ask them to do, the editors of the other journals?
Well, I just really took the lead from you and Kim. You know, this was a very collaborative project, and that came through to me as an attendee. I was no leader at that meeting. I was an attendee at that meeting because the topic is important to me as an editor, so I wanted to be there. But what came through very clearly from the beginning was how collaborative you wanted that process to be. And I wanted to emulate that in the way that we worked with the other editors who might be able to influence this more broadly than this relatively small number of people who attended the conference. I don't mean small, you know, in absolute numbers, but, you know, compared to the 80 something orthopedic journals, you know, they've got a pretty broad reach, you know, so the more buy-in we could get from them, the more impact your thoughtful conference is likely to have in the world. And I've seen prior projects like this where, a small cadre of people writes an editorial and says, this is the final or near final version. Who wants to sign on? And I think people find editors, well, heck with editors. I think people, you know, would find that off-putting. You're sort of force feeding something to them. It felt more collegial to me to say, hey, this meeting happened. If you weren't able to make it, here's where we are with what we think we know about it and what we think we would like to do about it. One of the important things would be to share this with your readership, particularly the authors who might submit to your journal. But each journal is different. We'd like everybody who's doing this kind of work as a journal editor to have a hand in shaping and participating in what we want to say so that everybody is comfortable at the end of it, or as many people as possible, with what we produce so that you can endorse it. And so to do that, we started with the full list, I think, of indexed or of journals indexed by Clarivate, which are the people who produce the impact factor. And that's 80 something orthopedic journals. And I think we were able to reach nearly all of them, at least by email, and give them the opportunity to participate. And the current numbers, but something between 20 and 30 have eventually signed on, and almost everybody who participated eventually chose to sign on, which I think is nice to see.
Yeah, it's great.
So Seth, I wonder, could you explain to those who are listening what the journals have signed on to? Like, what would be the key summary of the deliberations of the group?
Sure. So it's several main action items that the journals have agreed to do. One, and perhaps the most important one, is to have house standards. And we offered the journals to either adopt what's called the Sex and Gender Equity in Research, or SAGER guidelines, or if they already have published in-house guidelines that are substantially similar. For example, our journal does, and it differs in subtle ways, but ways that, you know, matter to us. That's fine too, as long as, you know, the journal has something that's explicit and articulated, so authors and readers know what they're getting involved with when they read from those journals. The second item had to do with building systems into review processes to make it more likely that authors would follow those guidelines. For example, asking reviewers to ask about whether data were disaggregated by sex and gender. And if the reviewers miss it, then perhaps the editors will do it. And this could be done in, you know, by adding questions to peer review forms to ask reviewers to comment, and also to suggest in author instructions that the authors explain these things. And if for whatever reason the authors feel that disaggregation wasn't appropriate to the study, then to explain why they felt that way, and if it's relevant, to discuss it as a limitation in the discussion. It's important to remember, you know, and this was sort of my naivete 15 years ago when I started on this, I thought just every article should do this. And when sometimes you see somewhat naive pronouncements made on this, that really is probably not appropriate. You know, if an article, if a study wasn't powered to ask a question, and as a journal editor, you see 100 of those and you ask all 100 to do a post hoc analysis, you're going to wind up with some misleading results. You're going to wind up with a lot of studies underpowered to answer a question, finding no differences and making erroneous conclusions. And those statistical errors can actually go in both directions, type one and type two error. So it's important that this be handled by authors, not by some fiat from the top by journal editors. So authors have a big say in presenting their work. We just want to make sure that they present it thoughtfully. If we think a paper, and this is also from our recommendation in the editorial, if we think a paper missed the ball on this and it was a reason for rejection, to make that clear so that the authors can learn from it. Other items had to do with the differences between sex and gender and making sure that that's clear and that authors handle that thoughtfully, and that they, both clinical and laboratory research deals with this sensibly. You know, cell lines can sometimes have sex. Animal research certainly has not been handled well in the past. I think in the Sager guidelines, it mentions that almost all of the animal research on pain included only male animals. And as Kim pointed out, you know, when you're talking about humans with pain, you know, gender matters too. And so to deal with this both in clinical and laboratory research was a point in our editorial.
Thanks for that. Kim, as I mentioned earlier in the interview, you've had extensive national level input into various organizations well outside of orthopedics, and you had a very thoughtful list of attendees. And I don't want to ask you to name them because for fear that somebody might be left off, but can you just give us, the audience, a sense of what your thinking was and who you invited to speak?
Well, as you said, I wanted to bring in people that were both within and outside of orthopedics so that we can see this as a broader perspective. As you mentioned, this is not just an issue with orthopedics. This is an issue that every area of medicine and research are trying to grapple with, or at least starting to think about. And I think with this effort, orthopedics can lead the way in this effort. But we had speakers who discussed the influence of sex on health, not just orthopedic health. Actually, the speaker focused mostly on diabetes, which, and cardiometabolic disease, which would seem to be far away from orthopedics, but actually not, because there's an overlap between that and osteoarthritis, and probably a common link in inflammation that you especially see in women. And so that was to show where we are from sex-based research. We discussed how gender is described in research, because sex, while not for everyone, may not be binary, and there's a more and more research coming out in terms of that from a biologic basis. Gender for some people is fluid, and so identifying what someone's gender is and how to incorporate that into research is not easy. And so we spoke about the influence of gender and how that could be included in research. And then we talked about how other areas can influence this, because the onus of improving this is not solely on journals, and I would say probably not primarily on journals. Again, I would get back to the researchers most likely being the ones that really need to take this on. But there are other areas, such as funding agencies. The National Institutes of Health have the sex as a biologic variable policy, which states that any application for funding for vertebrate or human research has to include mention of sex, gender, and why it is or is not included, and if not, an explanation of why not. We had some discussion of the role of IRBs. I think that they do play a role that's a somewhat controversial opinion within the IRB community. But if they're reviewing studies, perhaps that from an ethical perspective, need to make sure that the patients that are included in a project reflect the patients that could be impacted by the results of that study. And then we also talked about the downstream effects, which is not only in individual patient care, and as I mentioned before, development of clinical practice guidelines, but where is the data that helps inform curricula when we're teaching medical students, when we're teaching our residents, when we're involved in continuing education. That's all based on data. And if we don't have the sex-based data that we need, you don't have the material to help inform curricula. And so where do we get that data to hopefully improve the knowledge of sex and gender among our students and our trainees? Some discussion in the media of the concept of medical gaslighting, which is especially seen in women, where their complaints are ignored or dismissed or not treated appropriately, because their presentation is different than people were taught in medical school. Well, most of what they were taught was based on male models. And so how do we fix that? Well, it's improving the research and then getting that then to filter eventually into curricula.
You really did an outstanding job in organizing the conference, and thank you very much for your leadership. Mo, do you have a last question for our guests?
You know what? I mean, I could ask a lot of questions and I could keep us going here. But, you know, the one, I guess the comment I would say is it's initiatives like these that really become sort of the new standard for the way I think we should, be moving forward. And I always look at something as not being an end, but a new beginning. And so, the work you're doing just allows so many more of us to learn and get engaged more in an active than a passive way. So thank you, Mark, Kim, and Seth, for all your leadership in this area.
Well, I would like to ask our guests one final question. Seth and Kim, same question. What would be the absolute ideal outcome of this effort in your mind? Seth, you first, and then we'll let Kim sign off.
Well, I think that most of the good that can be done in the world on this subject happens way upstream of journals, mm-hmm. right? And so, my participation in this was, focused on the journal part, right? Helping to express what we wanted to express in an editorial that was, congenial to as many editors in our specialty as possible. So from that standpoint, it would be great if we start to see journals applying their standards more consistently, adopting these standards or something like them, and then sticking to that. Because you, Mark, as a journal editor, know that it's one thing to say that we adhere to some particular set of guidelines or standards, but journals are unruly things. They involve reviewers and editors and authors from all over the world, and even saying there's usually a distance between saying we're going to adhere to a standard and actually adhering to it. Mm-hmm. And so, if we can get greater adherence to that, that would really be helpful. But I think the bigger effort has to do with what Kim mentioned a minute ago, which is how much of this is upstream from journals. Mm-hmm. And so if people read this editorial and start to think as they're designing studies, I'm going to save myself the hassle of getting rejection letters from journals that are getting more serious about this, or I'm going to, just because it's the right thing to do, design my study to answer this question properly, which means answering it for all patients, not mm-hmm. predominantly patients of one gender or sex. Mm-hmm. And if IRBs, were to take a more hands-on approach, I think that's the area of greatest unmet need, in my opinion. That's the place where a lot of mistakes could be stopped. And I don't see any other ethical issue that seems more pressing to me than this that IRBs manage. So I don't know why they wouldn't be comfortable managing this. So it's always a little confusing to me when they say this is difficult for them. So I think the funders have done a great job. I think the big federal funders have really led the way, but there are lots of opportunities. And so, my dream here, Mark, would be, to see all of the entities that have a hand in this to take that bit of responsibility that's theirs and do the right thing with it.
Thanks very much, Seth, and thanks for your key participation in the conference. So, Kim, you got the last word.
Well, thank you. Thank you. I would agree with Seth. Although, again, the onus is not solely on journals. I think they can help lead the way by making their expectations clear. And so when people are designing their projects and looking for where they could publish something, if they see this, then hopefully early on, this is part of the design of the project and the design of their data analyses. So my dream would be that every project that's designed or every manuscript that we review, at least mention sex or gender. Again, if it's not appropriate for the study, explain why not. If it's just the wrong condition or the N is too small, at least mention it so that your readers are aware, and again, future researchers are aware that you've looked at it. So that would make my dream, is that it's everywhere, I think, on a very, very small scale. And working with some residents here on research, I've had a couple of the residents come to me with their projects, and they both included disaggregation of data based on sex. I didn't even have to push them. They just came to me with their project to make sure they were doing it correctly. And so that's a small success. That's two. Don't know what's going to happen to their projects, but that's at least, but it's a demonstration that if you talk, and they hear me talk about this ad nauseum, so that may be part of it. But I think if you at least talk about it, whether it's from the journal side or the IRB side, or if you engage faculty at academic institutions, if people hear about it, it becomes more something that people are starting to think about. And it just becomes how people see research. It's, yes, it's a fundamental shift, but it's giving people a different lens through which to see health, including musculoskeletal health.
Fantastic response. And you've been great guests. And for your time, you're going to receive this absolutely priceless Ortho Joe travel mug. You can't get them anywhere else other than being a guest on this. And there are a few that do show up on eBay, and they're priced at somewhere near an undiscovered Andy Warhol right now. So you'll receive those in the mail. And thanks very much for your time, and have a great day.
Awesome. Thank you, Mark.
Thank you so much. Thanks, everyone. Appreciate it.
Great job, Kim.
Thank you. You too.